We now will move on to Regulations Committee. Chairman Friedkin, please call your committee to order.
Thank you. First order of business is approval of previous committee meeting minutes. Motion for approval.
Aye.
Moved by Commissioner Hickson, second by Commissioner Hughes. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Committee item number one, update on Parks and Wildlife progress and implementing the TPWD Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Carter Smith. Just two things I want to report on. One is an update on a specific action item in the Land and Water Plan, and it has to do with the expectation that we will have appropriate education to commercial fishermen about regulation changes and gear changes. That, just so you know, is really an everyday process for our game wardens out on the water and our coastal fisheries staff. But there have been a couple of specific things that we've done, very targeted outreach to commercial fishermen over the course of summer. One, there was a new requirement about commercial fishermen sending in their trip tickets from their reports, and we had a letter out reminding them of the importance of that. Also, our law enforcement team, in working with Texas Sea Grant and the National Marine Fisheries Service, hosted a series of workshops and training exercises at coastal sites from Texas City to Brownsville to provide outreach to commercial fishermen, shrimpers, net makers on bycatch reduction device changes, and you're going to hear a little bit more about that, and also turtle excluder devices. But I think we had about a half dozen or so, Pete, around the coast, and I think those went very well. So just wanted you to know that action item is going on, but that's kind of a daily basis for us at the agency. The thing that I guess I really want to focus my discussion on this morning is in response to a request from Commissioner Duggins about an update as to where we stand with respect to deer breeder-related compliance and enforcement-related matters. Obviously, a lot of discussion at the last committee following the rules changes related to the Lacey Act and our ability to consider that a conviction, and whether or not to issue or reissue a deer breeder permit, and also how it affects the Triple T and DMP permit. So I guess just as a point of departure, just as a reminder, I mean, our law enforcement team really looks at the deer breeder industry like it does any other commercial enterprise involving fish and wildlife. And obviously there's a very strong biological component and outreach on that front. But we really approach it in three ways. There's an outreach and education component, there's a compliance and monitoring component, and then there's obviously a law enforcement component to it. And so let me try to hit the highlights of all three of those areas. Just as a quick status report, as of kind of mid-August, roughly 1,202, I think, permitted breeders in the state with about 1,254 licensed facilities and a little over 80,000 penned deer that are found within the confines of those facilities. With respect to education and outreach, you know, obviously we have a very strong dialogue with, you know, the leadership and the staff at the Texas Deer Association, Lisa Barton, Carl Kinsel, their board. We're talking with them all of the time about issues of importance to that group. We also have a breeder user group, which is an advisory committee that helps provide counsel to staff when we have issues that we're dealing with respect to deer breeding, and I want to talk about that a little bit more in just a moment. And then, of course, we've got very strong representation from deer breeders, biologists that work with deer breeders, veterinarians that work with deer breeders on our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee. And so that group is very, very well represented on that front. So a lot of education and outreach is happening all the time with the deer breeding community. With respect to compliance, this spring we started noticing problems with respect to permittee compliance, having their permits renewed, sending in the fees, making sure that we had the appropriate herd reconciliation forms that were submitted at the end of a permit year. We struggled with trying to improve that compliance. We had roughly 20 to 25%, I would say, of our permittees that were not compliant. So we felt like we probably needed to take fairly aggressive action. So the perfect opportunity to relay that to the breeder user group. We spoke with them about those challenges. They asked and encouraged us to take very strong action in that regard. Mitch Lockwood, working with our law enforcement team, sent out a letter to all of the non-compliant breeders in both June and July and told them that they had 30 days to get compliant. For that duration, they were no longer movement qualified, meaning that they could not move deer anywhere outside of their pens. And if they did not comply within that 30 days, then we would be rescinding their permit and we would be shutting down the operation. I think that letter helped a lot. We ended up getting about 80 to 85% compliance following that, very little complaints about that. For those breeders that chose not to respond to that letter, we then turned it over to law enforcement, and our game wardens went out and met with the breeders and then shut down those operations that needed to be shut down. Obviously, we had some instances in which breeders did not receive that letter for whatever reason, and obviously we extended their time to comply appropriately. So I think it was a very reasonable approach to it. But that's an issue that we had really worked hard on with Texas Deer Association and the Breeders Co-op and the Breeder Users Group to really, really push and get better compliance. It's important to us, important to the industry, it's important to law enforcement. The Lacey Act discussion at the May Commission meeting generated a lot of interest among many stakeholders and partners out there, legislators and so forth. Chairman Holt asked that we take a very strong measures to reach out to the affected groups after the Commission's decision. I want you to know that we absolutely did that. I sent a letter to the leadership of the three main organizations, well, really four, North American Deer Farmers, the Texas Deer Association, Texas Wildlife Association, and the Breeder Co-op Group that laid out what the new regulations were, just as importantly, what they were not, and how we intended to apply them going forward. So I think we were able to help explicate that. We met with a lot of legislators and legislative staff that had questions about it. And I think we're able to clarify a lot of the misimpressions or misinterpretations about that. We also met with the breeder user group to explain to that leadership, again, what these were and what they weren't, had a good dialogue with them as well as the Texas Wildlife Association. So a very strong push on that front, and I want you to know that we followed up just as we were asked by the commission and specifically Chairman Holt on that front. The new rules related to the Lacey Act and our ability to consider a conviction and whether or not we issue a deer breeder permit or reissue a permit, and also consider that on the issuances or reissuances of the DMPs or triple Ts are now in effect. We have had a couple of instances since they went into effect in August in which we had three or four deer breeders that had been convicted of Lacey Act violations and are currently serving time in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And we have made a decision on several cases to not reissue deer breeder permits based on those Lacey Act convictions. I think you heard Sergeant Chappell testify that there are a number of ongoing investigations with respect to individuals that are bringing deer across state lines illegally in violation of the Lacey Act, and obviously we're pursuing those with vigor. It's something that concerns us greatly, it concerns the industry greatly, it concerns the hunting community greatly, because we absolutely want to do everything we can to stop a disease like CWD from coming into our borders. So it's a major, major priority of law enforcement. There have been a number of fairly high-profile cases that some of you may have read about in the news in Kimball County, in Junction, down in deep south Texas, over in east Texas, with respect to convictions of individuals for deer breeder-related violations, Lacey Act violations, and so forth. And again, our law enforcement team is very much focused on that, where we have specific problem areas and where we have information. So it's a high priority. Again, working closely with all of the breeder community out there and the leadership of the organizations, and everybody understands how important it is to make sure that we weed out any bad actors that are out there. So I wanted to provide that high-level report to the commission. and see if you had any questions that I might be able to answer.
Thank you, Carter.
I went to the TWA conference and nobody beat me up. So, my point being is, I think you communicated it well. I think people say it the right way, even if they may not agree 100%. I think understood, and I think really that's what we were trying to accomplish initially. And then I think as they see, we apply this going forward, that this is not, as we talked about, you know, one extra bird gets. You know, hunters go across the state and you know, one extra bird is brought back in, and then all of a sudden we're going to take away their deer breeder permit. I mean, that never was what it was about. This is the most egregious issues that we will then have some ability, to make decisions on whether those individuals should be in the deer breeding business or not. And I think TDA, and talking to some of them, certainly they understood, if anything, it just helps, for lack of a better term, then weed out the bad apples and the people that give them generally a bad reputation, or potentially could give them a bad reputation. So I thought you did a good job of communicating that.
Good. Well, I appreciate that, Chairman. Yeah. And again, also leadership at both TWA and TDA in particular, that we work very, very closely okay. with, completely understand this issue. And I think we were able to provide a lot of clarification.
Right.
You know, just as a reminder, I think there have been about 11 Lacey Act convictions of Texas residents in the last 5 years. Now, we've had a few since that statistic was reported, and obviously where we catch folks, you know, we're going to go after them. There's no doubt about it.
Sure.
You're right, these are for the most egregious cases. And y'all also, as you will recall, made sure that when we were looking at whether or not to make a decision to issue or not reissue a permit, you know, we looked at the seriousness of the offense, the duration and time from which the offense occurred to the present, level of cooperator of that individual at the present, and just the overall gravity of the situation, and to use our best judgment on that. And so we've tried to communicate that as well, Chairman. So I appreciate your work.
Good.
Thanks. Thank you, Carter.
Carter, on a related subject, I've had several of the DMP stakeholders talk to me about extending the release date. And unanimously, I've probably had seven or eight I've talked to, and unanimously, they're all very thankful and agree that that's a good thing. So
good. Well, I appreciate that feedback, Commissioner. I've heard the same thing. I think that gave the appropriate level of flexibility to those permittees that felt like they wanted to hold their fawns a little bit longer, particularly in the southern part of the state. And you're right, I've gotten the same level of feedback. I think that was a very sound decision by the commission going forward.
Good. Thank you, Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Item 2, revisions to the exotic aquatic species rules. Request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Yeah.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski with the Inland Fisheries Division, and I'm here today to present our proposed revisions to the exotic aquatic plant rules, which includes a list of approved aquatic plants. Exotic aquatic plants have been used in Texas for many years, and in most cases have not caused any problems. They're commonly used in aquarium water gardens. They're very popular, and numerous businesses support these activities. Some, as we've noted in the past, such as water spinach, can be used as food items, and something that's been garnering a lot of interest recently is the use of algae for biofuels. Although most persons are responsible in their possession of these plants, some have escaped, and they can lead to problems in our natural habitats, and there are economic costs associated with that. We currently spend about $1.2 million treating plants such as hydrilla, water hyacinth, and giant sylvania. Currently, exotic aquatic plants are regulated by the use of prohibited lists. We do allow possession of some with the permit. In the recent legislative session, the Sunset Bill directed us to publish a list of plants that are approved, exotic plants that are approved for use in Texas. And that would be a direct opposite of the 20 plants that we currently have on the prohibited list. The bill further directed our agency to develop these rules to be as permissive as possible without allowing plants that would cause some damages. As always, our goal here is to apply sound science to this and protect our aquatic resources of Texas. We knew revising these rules would be a large undertaking, and which would require staff expertise from staff across the agency. We assembled an interdivisional team of that has done outstanding work on this, and I'm here representing all their exceptional work that we've done over the last few months of that. At various stages, we've had up to 18 people involved in that process. The goals of that team were to develop that list of exotic aquatic plants that are approved for sale in Texas and revise our rules to implement that program by the January 1st deadline, which was specified by the bill. As I noted in May, one of our challenges here was to identify all our user groups and stakeholders. We started back in November with a letter that we sent out to on the new regulatory direction and requesting for candidate plants. We started building our list. We tried to contact aquarium and water garden stores, various plant distributors, major pet store chains, the associations that are affiliated with, such as the Texas Nursery and Landscape Association, Texas Sea Trade Association, other agencies that we, state agencies that we knew we would be, have an interest in this. Over time we built in, added aquatic plant hobbyists, people, and have pond societies within the communities that are interested in these plants. And over time we've kept building on this and tried to get this information out to as many people as possible. After this initial letter, we did begin compilation of an approved list. Most of the input initially came from some of the distributors of plants. We compiled a draft listing of those of the approved list. We made another mailing to the stakeholders. This included an invitation for some meetings that we held in March around the state. We held 7 meetings at that time. We did add a couple additional meetings in June and July to address some specific needs through water gardens and also the algal biofuel industry. And over time, we continue to post this information on our website, all the various lists that we've been working on, the draft list, and in prior to this meeting, posting the proposed rules out on the site. Then we do have we will continue to use that as a vehicle to provide information to the public. Taking a look at our proposed rules, we decided since we are changing our regulatory direction here, we felt it was best to create a separate chapter for the exotic aquatic plant rules. Currently, those rules are in Chapter 57, and that also contains our rules on exotic fish and shellfish. To step through these proposed rules, looking at some of the highlights, we had to create some definitions. We had the exotic aquatic plant definition. We pretty much followed what was in the statute there to non-indigenous aquatic plants found in Texas, but we felt it was best to include not only vascular plants, but the macroalgae, microalgae, some of the genetically modified organisms associated with and hybrids of exotics. I want to define our approved list, which are those plants that can, exotic plants that can be possessed in Texas without a permit. We defined an ineligible list, which includes not only those 20 prohibited species on the current list, but also other plants that we do now feel would be best wise to be used in the state. This list won't be part of the rule. We will maintain it on our website and other media, and we'll be maintaining that over time. It's a crucial point here is to make sure we can identify those plants to the species level. This is important for our risk assessments that we're undertaking of the plants and also for enforcement purposes. One of the major portions of the revised rules are the exotic species permits. This would allow the possession of some plants not on the approved list, and this while safeguarding the environment and aiding enforcement. One of the things that when we were looking at these permits, we decided that for the exotic microalgae, with some of the specific characteristics of those. We decided that would be best regulated by permit only, and I'll mention a little bit more of those in a minute. The use of these permits, which we have existing now for some plants, would allow us to specify conditions and provide safeguards against escape and release. We tried to provide a number of categories of use there to specify to allow people currently in business in these activities to continue those. We can specify facility requirements, packaging and label specifications within this, and also emergency procedures. For instance, if there's a flood or anything, to safeguard against release within those permits. Just to briefly go over a little bit on microalgae, as you might have known, and we have certainly seen an escalating interest in biofuels or algae and biofuels. We do, because of their special characteristics, we do think they require separate treatment, use of permits only. In addition to our normal concerns about replacing native species, there are specific concerns associated with algae, with problematic blooms and toxicities, which we think requires extra scrutiny. And also, there's literally thousands of species and strains. Many of them are poorly under described and understood. We do recognize that we don't have as much expertise in these as some other organisms, so we have retained the use of a noted phycologist to help us work through some issues associated with the regulation of these organisms. And an important aspect of the construction of the approved list is our risk assessment. So we initially had a list of about 400 candidate species. That number's up to 445. All over the process, these lists have been sort of an evolving process as we gain more information, get input from the public. We've initially had TPWE staff evaluate these, use a widely accepted risk analyses. We had enlisted the aid of 30 staff in both coastal and inland fisheries to do these risk assessments. And based on some of my personal experience in talking to them, each assessment could take in the neighborhood of 4 to 5 hours. So this represents a tremendous, substantial effort on staff's parts to do an excellent job evaluating these plants. The risk analysis incorporates numerous factors on climate, growth of the plants, their adaptability, history of invasiveness, and at the end of the risk analysis, this results in three determinations: accept, evaluate, or reject. Naturally, the accepts are ones that we'd go on the approved list. The evaluate ones are ones that there might have been a couple indications of some concerns there, and ones we take an extra look at to make sure they haven't turned up as an invasive outside of their native range. Our assessments will be reviewed by the Texas TIPPC, the Texas Invasive Plant and Pest Council, as another way to ensure that we're doing a good job on these. Just to give you a little idea how some of these assessments are turning out, this represents 207 species we evaluated last Friday. That number has since increased. We do have some that result in a score that we will reject. And once again, those ones in the evaluate category are ones where we will take an extra look at to make sure they won't cause a problem. And this is a process we're using to address those directives in the bill to allow legitimate use while still protecting our aquatic resources. As I noted, the approved list will include those low-risk species. Currently, we have 170 species on that list for pending TIPPC review. We have approximately 94 species still pending, and assessment is continuing on those species along with the review by the outside agency. We do recognize that once we get these rules and the approved list in effect on January 1, there might be other species that people want to add in the future. After the January 1st date, if people want to do that, they will have to provide us with some information on risk assessment of these species. The staff will review that information for accuracy and completeness. And if we decide that those are plants that we can allow in Texas, we will bring them before the commission for your approval. Species that we previously determined to be ineligible will be reevaluated only with new information. That's where that maintaining of an eligible list will facilitate that process. One of the final portions of the new rules is on the transition period. Taking a look, we decided we needed some sort of a phase-in of these new rules since we are transitioning to a new regulatory scheme. So we're allowing from January 1 through the end of March. We will allow possession of exotic species pending permit issuance or review for addition to the approved list. And we will also provide information and ways for people with plants that are currently being allowed that don't make it to the approved list and won't be on the approved list, allow them to dispose of those illegal species in a safe manner. Future steps, we are continuing to evaluate those candidate species. We'll continue to solicit public input on the list and the rules. We have a meeting on September 1st scheduled to get public input on this. We're going to have, that'll be in Austin, and we'll allow people to either attend, participate by conference call, or even a web application that we will set up for that. After all few months, we'll continue to collect the public input on this, come back to you in November to discuss and consider the public input and to request your final approval. After a substantial effort on staff's part here, we believe the new regulatory direction that we're taking here will result in increased protection for the aquatic resources in Texas. And with that, I'd request your permission to publish the proposed rules revising the exotic plant rules and with the approved list in the Texas Register for Public Comment.
Thanks, Ken. Obviously a lot of work involved in that, so we really appreciate your department's efforts on the department's behalf. We've got a couple of questions. Go ahead.
Yeah, Ken, I have a question. Are there currently commercial operations in the state of Texas where they're taking the microalgae and making biofuels out of it?
I don't think there are any. That people are investigating. I don't think there's anyone that's functionally operating in that yet. There's a lot of interest in that, a lot of experimental processes, a lot of proposals to do that.
There are, just if I could clarify that, and you're right, Ken, I don't think it's reached the commercial stage, but there are definitely companies and universities that have active microalgae cultivation efforts, West Texas, Central Texas, and certainly planned for the coastal areas. So there's an algae task force, a biofuel task force that was established by the legislature that's been working on that. The Enterprise Fund has funded investments, for example, through Texas A&M to work on develop that as a fuel source. So there's a lot of interest in some operations that are out there now, more on the R&D side, I'd say.
And that independent review is being done concurrently, so it will all, they will be listed as well on the...
Yes.
For the November meeting, we'll have the complete list.
Yes.
Okay.
Because that's where the growth's really going to be, is all this experimentation.
Right.
And trying to...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I couldn't hear you.
Excuse me, that's where the growth is going to be. And they ask, because you've got an escalating interest for use in biofuels, is the experimentation, R&D, the expansion of trying to bring in new ones, and I guess crossbreeding and everything
that's
else you do. I mean, I think it's
there'll be a,
we're going to be
a process.
More, we're going to be hearing more and more of this.
That.
Yeah. Isn't that right, Ken?
Yep.
Yeah.
Commissioner Duggins.
I've already given you a number of comments to some of the language in there, but I do want to ask you about page 26 in the book, which would be 70.8, which is the provisional permit. It concerns me that this would, at least as I read it, allow possession of a of one of these plants without the facility being inspected. I ask that I'd like to know, has any consideration been given to a provisional issuance of a permit that does not permit you to possess or propagate the species until the permit, until the facility is actually inspected, so that they know they'll have the permit as long as they go ahead and build the facility in accordance with the plans and specifications. We then inspect it and confirm they've done so, they can immediately hit it and go.
Right, we'll consider that, and we do, do note in here that we will, if we provisionally approve it, we won't automatically give them full approval. It will be based on inspection when the facility was completed.
I think it needs to be clarified, though, in my view, that there's no possession or propagation permitted until the facility inspection is conducted.
Okay, well, we could address that.
That's my.
Now, currently, we don't have a provision for inspection, correct?
Well, we do have exotic species permits. We do inspect those facilities. Yes, like the water spinach, we do have a few other prohibited plants that we do have permits for. And for exotic fishes, we will inspect those facilities.
If I could clarify something really quickly on the provisional approval, that's really just intended to address the facility, not the possession of the species. One of the things we're requiring is that if someone is going to propagate any of these species, we want to inspect their facility. A lot of these folks want to, in order to get funding, et cetera, they need some assurance that we're going to be okay with their facility. You're right that we probably need to clarify that and make it clear that we're only talking about a provisional approval of the facility, not of the permit.
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
We just need to clarify what's the way it's written. It's not tight enough in my judgment.
Okay.
Any other questions?
I have a question. What's your comfort level on our ability to oversee all this,
yes,
as far as policing and... I mean, it's great to put all this in writing and to have it all, as stated, but do we have the personnel, do we have the ability to actually oversee this process?
Well, it's going to be a learning experience for our wardens out there, and we're going to try and provide them with as much information as we can to assist them. We do have, they are out there doing this work now, looking for prohibited species currently, and that's something that's ongoing that we're just going to have to make sure we give them the information and help them through the implementation of the new regulations.
Okay. But you do feel reasonably comfortable that we can stay on top of it?
Yes, we're going to make our best effort to do that, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate your efforts, Ken. Thank you. No further questions or discussions. I authorize staff to begin publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Committee item number 3, consistency of federal rules concerning bycatch reduction devices and IFQs.
For the record, my name is Robin Rikers of the Coast Fisheries Division, and as indicated, I'm here to present to you proposed rules to be considered for final action tomorrow regarding bycatch reduction devices and individual fishing quotas. The additional approved birds here are actually what we call two provisional birds. They were approved at an earlier time in 2008 that were basically designed to be in a testing phase. The reality of it is they didn't get enough people testing those birds, and the National Marine Fisheries Service again published a rule, and it became effective June 23rd of 2010, that would extend that date now until May 24th of 2012 to have those provisional birds still allowed in federal waters. And so what we're doing here is again proposing to you to accept the use of those testing birds, if you will, into state waters and federal waters, so that if people are moving in and outside that 9 nautical mile line, we don't cause them issues with the bird testing that's going on. Similar to that instance, in most recent times, we've also approved IFQ or individual fishing quotas for Gulf groupers and tilefish. Those were added to the original individual fishing quota program that we had in place for red snapper. Basically the same kind of rule set as far as how they have to land those fish, how they have to call in to law enforcement and let them know they're going to be at the dock, and the tracking of that quota as it is captured. With that, you know, again, what we're hoping to do here is adopt that into our state regulations so that it basically allows our officials to either make a state case or a federal case, depending on the size of the case and those kinds of issues. So it allows us to enforce those federal rules in state waters as well as outside of state waters. Since we reported, or since we made this slide, there has been one additional person to weigh in on the bycatch reduction device rules. We now have two in support of the rule and no opposition. In regards to the individual fishing quota rules, we have two in support of the rule and one opposition at this time. With that, that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Robin? Thank you. Okay. Appreciate it.
Sweet.
Okay. No further questions or discussion. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 4, status of quail in Texas. Mr. Robert Perez.
Good morning, Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Robert Perez, the Upland Game Bird Program Leader for the Wildlife Division, and I'm giving more of an informational presentation today on the overview, status, conservation, and future of Bob Whites in Texas. There are three other species of quail, but we'll focus today on Bob Whites. There's no doubt that Bob White quail have significantly declined. Here's some data from the Breeding Bird Survey over the past four decades. What happened? There's a long list of factors often blamed for the demise of quail, including predators, fire ants, feral hogs, but the fundamental cause is loss of habitat. There have been entire regions of the state that have been altered over the long term. Changes to Texas have happened slowly, day by day, for over a century. Fortunately, Texas is home to many conservation-minded organizations with programs targeting the restoration and conservation of quail. I think these groups working together is the key for any type of restoration. Major events that have influenced quail conservation include the completion of the first national recovery plan for Bob Whites in 2002, a statewide recovery plan in 2003, and more recently, a comprehensive game bird strategic plan that was blessed last week by the Game Bird Advisory Council in Austin. All of these plans target the restoration of Bob Whites to a baseline level of about 1980. Parks and Wildlife has supported and continues to support quail conservation efforts in Texas. The major headings here in yellow are goals taken directly from our strategic plan. The first here, promoting on-the-ground habitat restoration and conservation using proven management techniques. This includes our technical guidance out there with our field biologists, the purchase of equipment, herbicide, and labor on WMAs, wildlife management areas, developing upland game bird habitat, maintaining and existing partnerships and forming new ones. We've got relationships in writing with Audubon Texas Wildlife Habitat Federation and the Northern Bob White Conservation Initiative, where we use upland game bird stamp funds to support programs and policies that further quail conservation in Texas. We're also forming new relationships with folks like the newly formed Quail Coalition in the state. Some of these chapters are formerly with Quail Unlimited, and we're strengthening our relationship with that organization. Additionally, developing incentives to promote sound, science-based management activities on privately owned lands. Good examples of this would be our Pastures for Upland Game Bird program. It's a program where we basically kill exotics like Bermuda and Bahia grass and replace them with native species. We've got state wildlife grants where we go out and restore habitats into native grasslands as well, and a host of other programs that are designed in partnership with other agencies to either conserve or restore upland game bird habitats. Increasing educational opportunities for landowners, managers, and natural resource professionals is an area that we very much have been working on and could definitely do more. Here recently we completed an upland game bird management handbook, which we give out to all of our field staff and landowners. That's the nuts and bolts of how to manage for these species. increasing funding and manpower to target on-the-ground conservation of upland game bird habitats. It's definitely an area we could do more in. And I'm talking about direct management of habitat and applied research, or research that targets, say, problem areas where there may be species we don't know how to control that are taking over habitats. Here's a summary slide of some quail-related expenditures. These are focused on very specific projects and items that were directly at quail, not fringe benefits, salaries, things like that. This is an actual project that we can take down to the project level. But notice here on this slide that our research expenditures over the past four budget cycles have steadily declined, and our efforts in the management area have steadily increased. And totals are about the same on either side of the column there. And management, that's defined as partnership agreement with NGOs, wildlife management, habitat work, habitat projects, and private lands work. Habitat management is 9/10 of Bob White management. That's a quote from Fred Guthrie, some of you may have heard of, a well-known quail researcher at OSU right now. And basically, biologists have a good understanding about what a Bob White needs in the pasture. Bob White management is an active process. Bob White restoration, however, is about people, policy, and funding. Landscape level challenges make restoration a daunting task.
Yeah.
Some of these challenges include improper grazing, lack of fire, exotic grasses, and habitat fragmentation. They've got many challenges that they face every day, but these are the major ones. They've had an enormous impact on the Texas landscape. And all of these issues are specifically addressed in our strategic plan. The first, grazing management. Improper grazing reduces habitat. Grazing livestock is an integral part of rural Texas history and culture. But today's practices have been driven by advances in forage production, not wildlife conservation. High-quality nesting cover seems to be a major limiting factor across much of the state. Solutions here include partnerships and programs that specifically target enhancing rangelands for quail, and also developing more technical and financial incentives to get people to graze properly. Another area, prescribed fire. Fire suppression alters plant communities. Over the long term, without fire and ecosystems in Texas, what we see is woody species invade the uplands. And if you go long enough without fire, eventually you get so many woody species it just becomes too dense for quail and other grassland-type birds. Solutions here include providing equipment and training for staff. Our agency and our division have done quite a bit here in recent years, providing a large amount of equipment. We're working on training now, facilitating and fostering the development of prescribed burn cooperatives, which is based on the model of the Wildlife Management Cooperative, but it's more of a barn-building group of landowners that help each other out when they do burns and share equipment. We continue to support prescribed fire and federal farm bills, and also education and outreach, not only to landowners, but also to county commissioners when it comes to burn bans and lifting bird bans and understanding the importance of prescribed fire and wildlife management.
Before you leave that, can you elaborate on what the federal farm bill, what you're talking about on that?
Cost incentive programs from USDA, NRCS, or FSA with the CRP-type programs. Oftentimes, they'll have specific programs that target rangelands and enhancing them for quail. We work hand-in-hand with our State Technical Advisory Committee of the NRCS to make sure that is a practice that is allowed in CRP, allowed in some of these federally funded cost incentive programs. In years past, that wasn't maybe one of the practices they could do to maybe get their CRP in a shape that's been in for 10 years and has gotten too rank for quail. Working with them to allow that practice to get that vegetation down and usable again by pheasant, quail, other upland game birds. Exotic grasses, they're often poor habitat. I mean, Bermuda, Bahia, and a host of other grasses often are either sod forming and quail and other grassland birds can't physically walk through it, or they get too thick and crowd out food items, forbs and seed-producing plants that they need. Solutions here including supporting research on how to combat certain species like guinea grass or buffalo grass or KR bluestem, some of these species that we haven't really figured out how to get them replaced with native grasses. Producing educational materials for folks to really understand that having natives and running cows and natives makes sense both economically and environmentally. The rising cost of fuel and fertilizer makes native range very appealing right now. Native ranges don't require the inputs of fertilizer and supplements. We also could support and expand habitat delivery programs like the Pastures for Upland Birds program I previously mentioned. Habitat fragmentation. This reduces space for wildlife. Isolated populations of quail are more vulnerable. Quail have a boom-bust nature to their population, and when these fragments of land of good habitat become smaller and more distant, quail can become easily locally extirpated with no source of birds to reestablish. So in that scenario, anything can wipe out a small population and there's no place to replace it, no way to replace it. Solutions here include assisting existing cooperatives and providing incentives for the formation of new wildlife cooperatives. We've got examples including the Wildlife Habitat Federation, which we support, and also the Western Navarro Bobwhite Restoration Initiative, a couple of great examples of how folks can come together, get 501c3 tax-exempt status, get grants, and go out there and get people to come together, develop habitats, and actually bring back quail measurably on spring bird account, call counts. We've seen some really good things, and we need to encourage more of the same. So the keys to success, I think quail restoration and conservation in Texas really involves becoming more efficient with the existing resources and also leveraging funds and partnering with outside agencies wherever possible. Playing an active role in shaping future Farm Bill programs is also very important. In fact, we've got a full-time position dedicated to those issues. I think using a strategic focused approach to ensure that our efforts have a positive impact is also critical. Of course, we're always interested in ways to increase our capacity for conservation. In fact, as mentioned earlier, the Wildlife Division staff submitted an exceptional item for the agency's legislative appropriation request, that $2 million request, and if approved, that would provide significant additional resources to NGOs and other conservation partners, resulting in more enhancement practices on the ground. I don't take any questions.
Robert, thanks. If we can go back to the first, or I guess the second slide, how is this data gathered? Can you tell us a little bit about how birds per route and how this is compiled?
Okay, this survey, the Breeding Bird Survey, is a national survey, and it truly is a picture of the whole state. Parks and Wildlife biologists do run every year in August a roadside counts, but they're not statewide, so we can't get a statewide estimate. So I chose to use Breeding Bird Survey data, which is a volunteer-based survey in the spring where hundreds and hundreds of volunteers go out there and run routes for the Breeding Bird Survey. Many of them are associated with Audubon and other groups, and they're counting all the birds that they see. And so this is in all ecoregions of the state, and that data has been collected for the long term. It's a well-known data set that's been published in the literature, used for multiple species. Quail are still common enough to where they pick up enough of them to have valid data for this survey.
And so we've determined that it's habitat fragmentation, and for the most part, or at least that's the prevailing view, I guess, because they did that by isolating through this group of studies, by isolating unfragmented and seeing no population decline in unfragmented large land.
Correct. I think east of I-35 you see fragmentation, and west of it we still have large blocks where we have stable populations in South Texas and the rolling plains. So we have examples here where we have stable populations over the long term. We have areas east of 35 that have received great weather conditions over the years and rainfall, and sure. But there's no response by quail because the issue is something other than weather in those areas. It's habitat fragmentation.
Thanks.
I've got a question.
Commissioner Bennett.
Even on the large tracts of land, I think you're seeing a decrease in numbers. There may be ranches that have stable populations, but you got to define stable. I think that if you look over the 1970 to the 2008 time frame on this data set that you presented, that that maybe not that drastic a decline, but I think there is a decline that occurs in those. I'm speaking personally because I have a cattle operation north of Amarillo, which we basically view it as a grass growing operation because we want to complement the wildlife as well as the cattle. and we've seen decreased numbers over the same time period, which...
With no habitat change?
No habitat change at all. In fact, habitat improvement over the years. A great deal of habitat improvement. And so I think that in this whole quail study, we've got to address... I mean, there's another issue out there that we're not really getting our finger on. And I think that is shown in the example I'm giving you, and that, you know, it's not just the growth of the population of Texas and the fragmentation of the ranch lands on either side of I-35. There's something else out there that is affecting our populations, and I think that's something that obviously is a goal for this whole project.
Right, and in our strategic plan, we identify some of those areas in the research, that future research.
Right.
We want to be focused on management-oriented research that deals with those sorts of issues and gets at the heart of what those things may be. And we certainly don't know everything about quail, but as far as species goes, it's a well-studied species. Over 3,000 articles in the popular literature. A lot of work has been done by many biologists before me, and. And we do see a gradual decline. It seems to go from east to west. I think most recently in the cross timbers and prairies, where when I started my career 15 years ago, we were still picking up quail in our roadside count that our biologists conduct every year, and now we're not. Something happened there. I can't quite place my finger on it, as you mentioned, and it seems to be going from east to west. So there's definitely some things that we are still investigating, and we'll continue to do so.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
Hey, Robert, I've got a couple of questions. You showed a slide that over the last 4 years, there's been about $3 million spent on research and management. First question is, has that money come from the game bird stamp, or where is that coming from?
This is a combination of all funds. Stamps is one of the things included here, but it's not solely stamp. So the research column, those would include projects that were 25% funded by state funds, 75% federal, 50 federal, 50 stamp, and some that would be funded by different sources altogether, like, say, a native grass habitat restoration. I think earlier we talked about horned lizard license plate money. There is one project there that's looking at native grass restoration, and I think it's even some equipment purchases out of that fund that go towards really quail and other grassland birds.
Is $3 million just Bob Waters that bought quail from state funds?
These projects that I pulled for this slide are specifically quail-related. They're not turkey. There's probably two projects that are other quail. One on it would be scaled quail in West Texas, and one on Montezuma quail. But there's a smaller project, but identifying native grass restoration.
Yeah, there seems to be the economic value of quail in our state, $3 million over 4 years, is a pretty small expenditure in the Texas Department of Wildlife for because of the economic value they bring.
They do have a huge economic impact. Yes, sir.
That's a good point. Commissioner Duggan.
I want to echo what Mark said about the notion that it's 90% habitat, because the ranchers that I know in, for example, Shackford County, there hasn't been any fragmentation of their ranches. They're still running cattle the same way they were 20 years ago. They've done everything they know to do, but quail numbers have just plummeted. In fact, they've even eliminated quail hunting to try to see if that helps. So I challenge you and others to
join
Dan Allen on this, that we've got to find more funds to figure out exactly what's going on in those areas. We don't seem to, thankfully, be having those problems in South Texas like we are in West Texas and in near West Texas.
Right, yeah, and climate may be a big factor in warming of climates and long-term drought. We're at the western edge of that species range, and so they're far more susceptible to changes in temperature, climate, and the research done in that area shows that up to 80%, 70% of the annual variation year to year in quail can be directly attributed to rainfall or to drought indices. So even with the best grazing, the best habitat, even with the best intentions on a place at the western edge of the distribution, if the weather doesn't cooperate, you still may see declines. So you got to look at long-term data sets to kind of see how often quail can respond when climate cooperates. So we look at a 5 to 7 year boom in Texas, in those areas in Shackelford County and South Texas, where the weather cooperates enough years in a row that quail have the time to respond. And so we do see the anomalies where we see these declines, especially after 2 or 3 years of substandard weather. We also see, I'm hoping, in the next few years to come, if we get more favorable weather like we did this past summer and this past winter, that we'll see those responses in some of those areas, I hope.
This hunting season should provide a pretty good data set with, it seems like most of the areas that have had quail in the past got substantial rainfall this year.
Yes, sir, correct. They did.
Any other questions? Thank you. Appreciate it. All right, item number 5, migratory game bird proclamation rules. Dave Morrison.
Good morning. My name is Dave Morrison. I'm the waterfowl program leader for the Wildlife Division. This morning I'm going to be presenting the 2010-2011 final late season proposals for ducks, geese, cranes, and mergansers. But before I do that, just quick update on the 2010-2011 early seasons. Those season dates and bag limits have been submitted and approved by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There was no significant changes, no changes at all from what we presented to the Commission last May. The 2010-2011 seasons began development late last winter when the Wildlife Division's Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee got together. That's an internal group that worked together to look at different ways of approaching how we establish season dates for late seasons. Two key elements were minimize conflicts, maximize opportunity. So it was the focus of what we did. What we presented to you in May was a result of that meeting. So the seasons then we gave to you were preliminary. Since that time, we've gone through the habitat evaluation, we've looked at breeding populations, we've had our flyway meetings, we've met with the Service Regulations Committee that has developed the final frameworks for the duck seasons, and we're here today to present to you the results of all that. I'm happy to say that since we presented this to you last May, there's only been two minor modifications that we're going to ask you guys, ladies and gentlemen, to consider changing from our original proposal. With that said, I'm going to move into the season dates. I forgot to add that last week we did meet with our Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee, and they supported these proposals unanimously. Proposals for the High Plains Mallard Management Unit are basically calendar adjustments from last year, with youth season opening October 16th and 17th, general gun season for weekend on October 23rd, 24th, closed for a few days, open on a Friday, October 29th, and run through January 23rd. Once again, after last year, Fish and Wildlife Service required that Texas and Louisiana reduce harvest on mottled ducks. As a result, we have been told to have another 5-day closure on mottled ducks, and so in the High Plains Mallard Management Unit, the dusky duck, which is the term we're using now because we are trying to minimize conflicts with hunters when they try to identify these birds. So we have thrown the mottled duck in with the Mexican-like duck, the black duck, and its hybrids to ease any concerns with people misidentifying those birds. And so the bag limit on those will be one, but you cannot take those until after the first 5 days of the season. I will say that in the High Plains Mallard Management Unit, we are taking full advantage of the maximum days allowed on the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is 107 days of exposure for all seasons. This is what that season would look like on a calendar, with the gray dates being the youth season and the orange dates being the regular season. In the north and south zone, have similar seasons to last year, simply adjust for calendar. Youth season opening on October 23rd, 24th, general gun from October 30th, November 28th. Close for a couple of weeks, reopen on December the 11th, and run through January 23rd. That pesky dusky duck season will be from November the 4th through the 28th and run concurrent with the second split. This is what it looks like on the calendar. Again, the gray shaded areas being the youth season, the green being the regular season. I mentioned earlier that there was a couple of minor changes from the original proposal. This slide depicts one of them. Pintail populations and habitat conditions this year were pretty good. As a result, plug all the information into various models, we now believe that there are sufficient pintails out there to withstand a 2 pintail bag limit. This is a change from last year, and one of the modifications to the original proposals that we'll be seeking your approval on. Nothing else changed with respect to bag limits from last year. In the West Goose Zone, counter adjustments from last year, November 6th and February 6th, which would be the season structure for both light and dark geese. No change in the bag limit on white geese. However, there was a change for dark geese. The Fish and Wildlife Service has looked at our various population information and determined that the canid geese in the west zone of Texas probably can withstand some additional hunting opportunity. So as a result, that bag limit changed to 5 in the aggregate to include no more than one white front. It's a little bit different from last year. It was still 5 in the aggregate, but you can only take 4 canidas in white front. So now people out there, particularly in high plains, can shoot 5 canada geese. Light goose conservation order will be from February 7th to March 27th. In the east goose zone, no change from last year, no change from the May proposal. The light and canada geese will be October 30th to January 23rd. White fronts will open with those two, but they do have to close earlier simply because our management plans require a shorter season. Bag limits are unchanged from last year with 20 in the aggregate for white geese, 5 in the aggregate with no more than 3 canadas or 2 white fronts. The conservation order will open the day after duck season. It would close on January 24th and run through March 27th. Proposed sandhill dates are in Zone A, would run concurrent with the goose season from November 6th to February 6th. In Zone B, we delay the opening to allow those any whoopers that may be passed through that country to get through and beyond, so there's no conflict with sandhill crane hunting and endangered species. And in Zone C, we're taking full advantage of the maximum of days allowed by the Fish and Wildlife Service, that being 37, and we're having a bag limit of 2. Falconry dates. Because we take full advantage of the 107 days allowed by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act in the High Plains, there is no extended falconry season there. However, in the north and south zones, we do have an opportunity for extended falconry season. That would be from January 24th to February the 7th. Public comments. As always, there are public comments because ducks is, to me, one of the most important things out there for our sportsmen to enjoy. We did get about over 600 comments. It was 350 support of the proposals, while there were about 270 disagreeing with all or part of the proposal. I need to point out that the bulk of the comments came with respect to the season structure. 113 people commented they wanted the season to run later and extend to the end of the framework, which is the last Sunday in January. You see here that 87 gave no specific reference, 19 wanted in the north, 6 in the south, 1 in the High Plains Mallard Management Unit. Tied to that, staggering the north and south zone opening dates, having a little bit different split between those two, and that's kind of interrelated with the extension of the frameworks. As I said, the proposals that have presented were developed looking at minimizing conflict, maximizing opportunity. But there are some people that don't necessarily support the proposals that we have laid out there in front of you. There were some comments to eliminate modified split. There were 43 comments asking me why I was dumb enough not to recommend 2 pintails. Well, that's because the proposal, original proposal, had one, and we had to carry that forward. The Wildlife Division is making a request to modify the proposal to allow the taking of 2. There were 27 requests for youth hunt. Most of those centered around the structure of the season when it occurred. Again, tied to the framework, pushing the season later. There were some that requested put in the middle, some wanted and after the season closed. On geese, there were 13 people wanted a later opening. There were some wanted a delayed opening for the white front so they could run concurrent with the rest of them so they all would end the same day. As always, the snow goose bag limit was in there. Some wanted reduced, some wanted increased. And there's 10 comments on the conservation order from eliminating it to make it longer, so it was a kind of a hodgepodge of everything. So tomorrow we'll be here again requesting permission or requesting the commission adopt the amendments to that paragraph concerning migratory game birds with changes as necessary to the proposed text published in the May 21st, 2010 issue of the Texas Register. With that, I'm finished and be happy to take any questions you have.
Thanks, Dave. Commissioner Bivens has a question.
I'd like to ask on the comments on reduced bag limit for snow geese. What is their reasoning?
We have seen over the last several years declining numbers in the coastal zone of Texas with respect to white geese. Those numbers are declining.
Regional specific.
It's reasonably specific. Nationally, we still have the same problem. But in that particular area, there are people that suggest, and I have even discussed it with people about the possibility of reducing the bag limit, trying to keep those birds in and around longer. I don't think it's going to necessarily reduce the total harvest, but I think it would keep those birds around longer.
I see. Thank you.
Any other questions for Dave? Commissioner Douglas?
The comment about trying to move the youth hunt dates from October 23 and 4, which do seem pretty early, is there any way to try to accommodate that? I mean, the goal is to try to get these kids out and let them have a good experience, and if it's too early in the season, I'm not sure we accomplish the purpose.
Two trains of thought there. Yes, it is early. But you look at migration chronology of ducks showing up in Texas. Migration is in full swing. It's different species. A lot of blue wings, a lot of gadwall, a lot of shovelers. So there are ducks available based on migration chronology. And if you look at our harvest, there are reasonable numbers of birds available at opening weekend. Now, I won't disagree that that is a little bit early. However, when you're trying to develop that youth clientele, you want to give them the opportunity, first crack out of the bat, when the ducks are done. Now, if you push it later in the year, well, there's a lot fewer ducks to begin with because they've been hunted. They're a lot more difficult to hunt from the standpoint they've already wised to this game. And lastly, biology of the bird, they've already paired up. They don't want to be in where their mate might be stolen, so they're trying to stay away from these concentrations of birds, so it's a little bit tougher to hunt. If you wanted to do something with respect to modifying the youth hunt, one of the things that could be considered would be in the middle, if you will, during the split, because you do have one weekend of a split between the first and second split. So if you were considering moving it, I think that pushing it later would probably be my last recommendation to anybody. Putting it in the middle would be a potential, but you always have to consider that anywhere you push it beyond out front, you're hunting birds that have been shot at, and they're going to be a little bit tougher to deal with.
Well, but couldn't you move it to the 30th and the 31st of October? That's 1 week.
If you wanted to shift the entire season structure, yes, sir, you could.
I don't see how anybody can. I mean, the youth can't shoot blue wing in the north zone in October because isn't that a September?
No, sir. Well, if blue wings are available, yes, sir, they can. The September till season is for blue wings specifically, but that does not preclude you from shooting blue wings during the regular season.
Well, I'd like to encourage us to look at that issue for next year if nobody wants to change it this year, and I'm not suggesting we change it. I just think we ought to look at it going forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Be happy to.
I think that makes sense. We can certainly gather some information, some data from this year. So, good. I appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. No further questions or discussion. I'll place the 2010-2011 late season migratory regulations item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 6, update on the joint enforcement agreement between TPWD and NOAA and National Marine Fisheries Service. Mr. Robert Goodrich.
Thank you, Commissioners. Robert Goodrich, Assistant Chief of Fisheries Enforcement. Coming for you today to give you an update about the joint enforcement agreement we have with NOAA and National Marine Fisheries. Just give you a little insight into where we are in this scheme of things. You know, of course, it comes from the U.S. Department of Commerce. We're part of a joint enforcement team, and that boils all the way down into National Marine Fisheries Service Office of Law Enforcement, and we're part of that Southeastern Division. Now, all the Gulf states have joint enforcement agreements with NOAA. And what we're going to do is talk, I'm just going to give you a brief overview of where we are in ours. Again, we're represented by NOAA and National Marine Fisheries. They have four agents and an assistant senior agent in charge that's here in Texas, two on the lower coast and two on the upper coast. Again, game wardens are deputy enforcement officers under their authority. We do this cooperative agreement. It provides enforcement for the assistance in federal regulations, but you know, we're out there patrolling for state resources and state regulations, and we do this in conjunction with that. So we're actually wearing a couple of hats out there and enforcing these regulations. What it does for the federal regulations is it allows us to protect resources that are all of our resources out there, you know, because even though those are some federal regulations, there are resources we all enjoy in Texas as well. Again, those funds that we get from this enforcement effort, we actually allocate hours in the contract. Those hours are dedicated based on the vessels and the officers out there in them, and it's a contractual agreement where we track it as we go through the year. Every month we make a report on how we're doing, wardens report on what their efforts are towards this JA enforcement effort, and out of those funds we fund patrols, our fuel purchases, some of our fuel purchases are supplemented there, boat purchases, and boat and equipment repair. This vessel right here is one of the new safe boats, full cabin, 29 footers that we have, and that was bought with JA funds. Again, game wardens patrol out to 9 nautical miles and inside the water, inside and outside waters. One of the things we work a lot with NOAA with is the TED enforcement for turtle excluder devices. And again, that's a device that it helps when the shrimp go through the net and the turtle comes in there, it excludes the turtle out of the net. And it's very critical to enforcing that regulation to get that equipment done right and make sure that it's being fished correctly out there. And that's, we do this in addition to checking regular commercial activity and recreational activity that's out there as well. Again, TEDs have specific, they have specific things in the net, regulations, measurements all have to be met and qualified. And another thing that goes along with that is the bycatch reduction device, which Coastal talked to you a little bit about before. That's to reduce the amount of finfish that are captured and killed inside the shrimp net. So it's very important that those are installed in the bag correctly, and that's one of the things the wardens go out there and do is make sure that the TEDs and the BRDs, they're in there correctly and being fished properly. Well, the other thing that we work closely with National Marine Fisheries with is IFQ quotas. Now, fishermen fish federally in federal waters and come and land their catch in Texas, and they have allocations for quotas, like red snapper, like this group picture here. They come in and they land those quotas, and we do dockside inspections under that authority to make sure that they're staying inside their quotas and that they're meeting the regulations. And again, that's a protecting a fishery that we enjoy as well as Texans out there. Outreach is a big part of this. This agreement provides funding for outreach. So this effort that we have done over the years, we every year we go out there and do outreach with a commercial fisherman, and this funds some of that effort. And when we develop a good working relationship with the NOAA gear specialist, and they go out there with us, and we actually show fishermen how to get it right, make sure they've got it right, and then so hopefully when we board the vessel, it's being done correctly. Mm-hmm. And towards that end. We did that this year in 7 locations along the coast, and we did get a lot of net makers in this one as well, which is very critical so that the net makers get it in there right for the fishermen. Just a little background on it. We've been in this from 2002, 8 years. That's the amount of money there, almost $6 million in that 8-year period that we realized out of this contract. We just did an additional amendment for this year because we needed increased patrols for TED enforcement. We were having some turtles show up in Texas on Texas shores, and they wanted us to increase our enforcement effort, and we got with them and we negotiated an amendment to our contract, and we put an airplane up and did some extra patrol out there, which we feel was very beneficial to prevent any violations. And lastly, we just negotiated our new one. This is our new for 2010-2011. $600,000 for this year is where we're at, and it's come up a little each year. So we're showing them that we're doing a much better job, and we're growing the program, so to speak. This new safe boat that I wanted to show you right here is already going to be part of our purchase this next year. That's a 38-foot. Boat for the Middle Coast, and that's going to give us some coverage in the Middle Coast area where we didn't have that kind of coverage with the bigger vessels were on the upper and lower, so we're going to have a little more coverage in the Middle Coast area.
Look at the horsepower on that thing.
Around 55 to 60 in open seas, it'll run very fast.
Yeah.
And it's quite a ride. If we like the 29-footer, if you haven't had a chance to ride on that closed cabin one, it's really an experience. This boat is so maneuverable because it will do a complete 180. You know, there's a lot of torque inside that cabin, but it will do a complete 180 at about 45. So it's a very maneuverable vessel. And it's in its nature, safe boat. That's what it says. It's much safer for the wardens out there, too. I did want to mention one thing before I leave. Is I've got my lieutenant here. It's Lieutenant Fred Reese is in the back. Right here, I just want to recognize him because he helps coordinate this effort down there. He between the upper and lower coast, the two regions, he makes sure that this agreement's being met and that all those activities are going on. But much more than that, he's coordinated a lot of special enforcement efforts that are for state regulations as well. So he's one of those guys that makes it happen, and I wanted him to be here today and let y'all know that. And really, that's all I have. If you have any other questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Any questions? It's terrific. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. I think our Regs Committee has completed its business.